In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
That's the great potential of a list like this, is to open up avenues of history that maybe aren't part of the sort of general mainstream understanding of history.
That was Joanne Poole discussing our poll on 100 women who changed the world.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Earlier this year, we ran a poll where we asked you to vote for the women you felt had made the biggest impact on the world, out of a list of 100 who'd been nominated by 10 expert historians. The results have now come in and were revealed in our September issue and can also be found online at historyextra.com/100womenresults. Topping the vote was Marie Curie, the Polish-born French scientist whose research earned her 2 Nobel Prizes. She was followed by the American civil rights activist Rosa Parks, the suffragette leader Emmeline Pankhurst, the 19th century mathematician Ada Lovelace, and the crystallographer Rosalind Franklin, who played an important role in the discovery of the structure of DNA. There's already been lots of discussion of the results in the press and on social media, and in today's episode of the podcast, we're going to be exploring the vote further with a panel of 3 experts. Putting the questions to them was our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman.
I'm June Purvis. I'm Professor of Women's and Gender History Emerita at the University of Portsmouth.
I'm Dr. Livette Vitelli, reader in history, and I'm working on colonial and post-colonial history.
Dr. Joanne Paul. I'm lecturer in early modern history at the University of Sussex. The poll that we've just released the results for saw Marie Curie as number one. Was that a surprise to anybody, do you think? Why do you think she kind of resonated with readers so much?
Well, I would say that because of the publicity and the story about breast cancer, people are aware of Marie Curie, not necessarily about her work as such, but they're aware of her, you know, the result of what she did.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm not surprised at all and happy with the result, actually.
I was surprised, actually, that she was selected as the top sort of candidate, but I was delighted that she was because I think she's been very much in the shadows in terms of great women who have changed the world. Her influence has been so influential, not only as the first professor at the University of Paris, but all this work she did on radium.
So what surprised you about the fact that she came to it? Was it because she was a scientist or...?
Yes, I think because she was a scientist, and I wonder if Patricia, who nominated her, whether the people she contacted, whether the science community was very cohesive and thought we've got to have this woman there, because she hasn't, as far as I'm aware, she hasn't had a lot of publicity this year, has she?
Yeah, it's interesting. When we spoke last year about the sort of top 100 list, one of the things we noticed was the influence of television programs or books that had just come out recently about certain people. And yeah, I'm not aware of that for Marie Curie either. But I think what we see with Marie Curie is this perfect combination of tangible influence that we can sort of see and think about every day, and we learn about her in school, and we learn about topics related to her in school so people can understand what it is that she's contributed, as well as a fantastic story. And so I think that this sort of Venn diagram, I guess, this overlap of those two things is probably what put her there, but I wouldn't have necessarily predicted it.
Okay. I mean, June, you were one of the nominators for the poll. You must be quite happy to see Emmeline Pankhurst in the top three.
Yes, I was delighted. I was very delighted that she was in the top three because she was a woman who did change the world. She had an international status. I'm holding a big conference shortly at Portsmouth, and we've got papers from Japan, from the USA, from Canada, from Australia, which look at her influence. So what she did, in fact, was to say that women shouldn't accept their subordinate station politically. They should stand on their own two feet, develop a backbone, and articulate their demand for the vote. So I think she was very influential.
Do you think if it hadn't been the centenary of the Act that gave some women the vote in Britain, do you think she would have come as highly in the poll? Is she a name that people are familiar with anyway?
Yes. I mean, if you look at Time magazine, 1999, she was elected as the top figure. The Observer elected her as a top figure as well. So I think I expected to see her amongst the top five at least.
Any surprises in the list from anybody? What did you think, Olivette? Did you have any surprise entries or omissions even?
I have. lots and lots of omission. I was thinking about those sort of women who are on the news, not necessarily seen in a great light, but who should have made a list. And I'm thinking about I think Rigoberta Menchu, who was an activist, South American, because we don't have many people from South America or Central America, activists, you know, working for indigenous population, Nobel Prize nominee, and she won the prize. Yeah. And another one, I don't necessarily share her ideas, Dilma Rousseff, first Brazilian president, and more recently, Aung San Suu Kyi. With a Rohingya question. So I was hoping to see them on the list as well, but for other reasons that we would expect, really.
Okay, what about you two? Did you have any surprises?
I think there were a number of names on there that I'm both, in a sense, sort of ashamed, but also very pleased to say that I didn't recognize. I didn't know who they were. And not all of them have I been able to go through and sort of read about them. And I guess in some sense I'm surprised, but again, very pleased by that, that there are names on there that maybe a lot of people didn't recognize or didn't know about. And I think the way that this list was put together with the nominations, rather than just people contributing, it allows for that a little bit more. And I think that that's the great potential of a list like this,
is to open up avenues of history that maybe aren't part of the sort of general mainstream understanding of history.
Yeah.
I mean, I was surprised to see Sonia Heaney, the skater and film star. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what number she was. Have you got it there?
I can have a look.
Yeah.
She was, where did I see that? Oh, 76.
76. Mm. And I thought, gosh, who's put her in? Because I wouldn't have called her a woman who changed the world. But then perhaps she was influential as an early woman skater, which I quite frankly, I don't know about.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing to remember is that we asked 10 historians. They were each given a category.
Yes.
Their own, that's right, politics, revolutionaries and activists, weren't
yes.
they? So they were sort of confined to that.
Yeah.
That area,
yeah.
And we had a sports category.
Yeah.
So I think these are kind of women who kind of changed the world in the sporting world, I suppose.
I think the one that actually surprised me the most and has caused all sorts of, I've been doing all sorts of reflection about it and whether what I think about it, but was the Virgin Mary.
Yes.
I think that surprised me the most that got in there because I think with my historian's hat on, and I apologize to my vicar, my immediate reaction is evidence and wondering. But on the other side of it, I think it's a wonderful inclusion because it speaks to something that I feel is missing from this list necessarily, which is an understanding of sort of women's movements and a little bit more of a sort of social cultural history that I think is very important to women's history that can't be represented by a list like this. So actually on reflection, perhaps it is actually a wonderful inclusion, but it did strike me immediately when I encountered this list.
Yeah. I mean, there's whatever your thoughts on the Virgin Mary, there's no doubt that her influence over history has
completely,
been phenomenal.
Completely. And I wonder if Eve should have been on here too, for similar reasons. Mm. And these sorts of, his sort of historical cultural movement and presence rather than necessarily evidence of an individual. And I think that is something that is actually good to think about in the context of this list.
Mm. That's really interesting because you say Eve and I think Aisha.
Ah,
She's in there. And I thought, oh, Eve's not there then.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't immediately think about that to start with. Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah.
But I think you could connect the Virgin Mary with spirituality, which has always been quite important, I think, in women's movements.
Completely.
And very much under-researched.
Mm. Yes.
In fact.
Yes.
Joanne, you were one of the, you and Olivette both gave some analysis on the list in the feature. You noted that most of the top 20 had made sort of history in the last 300 years. Why do you think there are fewer sort of ancient women making an appearance in the list?
I think it's the further you go back, the harder it is to recover individual women making contributions. And I think that there's a number of reasons for that. You know, in the early modern period, it became more common to sort of subsume a woman underneath her husband or her father in official records. So that becomes very, very difficult. We have fewer letters. We have, and so on and so forth. Also, what happens, I think, predominantly in the early modern period, though probably it's medieval as well, is that the expectation of women's influence is such that the better that influence is, the more influential that pressure is, the more invisible it is. And in fact, that was successful. For instance, advice giving was that you couldn't recover it, that it was so soft power that we have no record for it. For instance, now, I think another factor is what we recognize to be influence, what we value as a contribution, and this is a worry I have about this list a little bit, is in a sense shaped by a sort of masculine understanding of history, that it's politics, that it's sport, that it's military, that it's so on, those sort of quintessential ways of thinking about history. Whereas a sort of more cultural or artistic, you know, women have changed the world by it sounds frivolous, but by choosing an outfit, right? Women have changed the world by introducing people. Women have changed the world by facilitating salons. Women have changed the world in all sorts of ways that are more, I think, difficult to quantify and that tend to fall less into the sphere of sort of traditional history. So that's, sorry, a long way of saying, I think the further you go back, the more those factors are the case and the more difficult it is as a historian to recover individual women who aren't taking on traditional male roles. Mm. You know, take the example of Lady Jane Grey, who I'm thinking about a lot at the moment. We have almost no record for her. She's very difficult to find until she becomes Queen of England, until she takes on a more sort of traditional male role. Then we've got her. But until that point, she might as well not exist.
Yeah. Mm. Would you both agree with that?
Yes. And I would add something else. Because I work on colonial history, things are different. True that we tend to focus on kind of military, male-dominated history. But even then, I'm thinking about Queen Nzinga that people don't talk much about, who was a diplomat and a military leader,
yeah,
and who fought against the Portuguese. Well, we don't remember her. We remember the Portuguese invasion and colonization and all the historians and all the people who contributed to that. But we don't remember that woman who was in Africa. Mm. Why is that? Mm. You know, because there are records and there are things about her, not that many.
Yeah.
But having said that, I completely agree with you because, yes, women changed the world by choosing outfit. Coco Chanel was only number 30, I think, yeah. I noticed. Or no, it's not.
We had Estée Lauder there. I saw that.
Yes, yeah. But these women left their imprint in our daily lives.
Yeah.
And yet they're far at the back because we still consider that it's the, I don't know, maybe the military or maybe the ones who had kind of noble, so-called noble influence that matter, who matter. So it's a pity, really. Musicians are not... don't feature that much in there. And I was incredibly surprised. But then again, it tells us a lot about what we think is matters at this instance.
Do you think that's because we have perhaps a Western way of looking at history? That's perhaps why this is it Queen Nzinga, do you say?
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't remembered or known about as much.
I think so, because, for example, I was thinking about, I don't know, we talked about Africa, but I'm thinking about... Miriam Makeba, who's known as Mama Africa. So she was a musician, an activist, and in so many ways a historian as well, writing, documenting all sort of activist movement and joining Africa and the States because she married a Black Panther leader. So she brought together all these things with the arts as well, and jazz in particular. So why is it that, not just her, but why is it that those musicians, these women are not featured there, because they did tell stories in different ways, you know. So. Yeah, I was incredibly happy to see a lot of women of colour there.
Yeah.
So, yes. I'm
I think that's really an important point. You know, there's been a change over the last 10 years to make Black women and women of colour much more prominent. And, I mean, I nominated Rosa Parks, and I was utterly delighted that she was listed as number two, because she was very influential. And she wasn't if I remember correctly, she wasn't from an established middle-class family. She was working class.
Yeah.
And this brave act in 1955 of challenging segregation in the South, and that led to the civil rights movement. She lost her job. She had to move her house and everything. So I'm delighted to see her there. To go back to a point that you made about, you know, we're seeing history in sort of male models. I'm not sure that's entirely true, because even if you take people like Emmeline Pankhurst, she led in a different way to most men. She was always in the front of the action, but she also brought women with her in a way. And, you know, I think we've got to remember that it's very difficult for women to be leaders. Take Thatcher, for example, Margaret Thatcher. Everybody criticises her as being not bringing women with her, etc. But I think she had to fight a lot of sexism within the Tory party. within Parliament. There are all those criticisms about her clothes and the way she spoke, etc. So I think it is difficult for a woman to have a leadership role.
Mm.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When we look back, when we look at women's history, do you think that there's kind of an argument that we should be looking at achievements and what they did, well, rather than from a gender perspective and kind of irrespective of their gender, look at women in history as what they did? Do you think that's a good way of looking at women's history, or do you think that then we run the risk of sort of not appreciating the struggles that they went through as women, perhaps what was then a man's world?
I'm laughing because I read one of the comments here from a guide.
That's what, yes.
And I thought, well, I can understand where he's coming from, but he's not a woman. I mean, a lot of these women went through fights to get to where they were as women, so you can't just ignore it.
No.
And that's my view anyway.
Mm. Yeah, I think it varies by context. You know, I think, you know, there are certain fields. You go back far enough and all of the fields are difficult as a woman. But I mean, I think that there are certain fields for which is more or less difficult. It's difficult in different ways. Add in, of course, the difficulties faced by women of color, or I'm not sure we really got into with this list, women expressing themselves in different sexualities, or you know, the difficulties of just sort of existing on the margins in various different ways. And so I think, you know, I'm always dubious of sort of hard and fast rules. Either we take it into account or we don't take it into account. I think it is something that we have to think about in context. And often it is, the further back you go, the harder it is, I think, for women to sort of emerge, to break in.
And I think what we've got to remember, you know, if you look at women's history in England, it really started off with Sheila Rowbottom's book, Hidden from History, 300 years of women's oppression. And so it's relatively recent, you know, it wasn't until the 1970s and beyond that people have started to research women's history, particularly feminist historians. And there was a concern to document the lives of the less famous working class women, women working in factories, in laundries, working class women in political movements like the suffrage movement, the trade union movement. So there has been that concern to find voices and also to change the representation of women, because if you look at lot of the male-centered, male-dominated history, women were present usually in their relation to men, as wives of famous men, you know, or mothers of famous men, or mistresses, etc. So I think that has been a big challenge, and there is a lot of research now on these other women who are agents in their own right.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, just on that as well, I think increasingly we're seeing a lot of research as well looking at the agency of maybe this sounds like a dismissive term, of everyday women,
right?
The way that women used systems that were designed to oppress them in order to express their own agency, or to find loopholes in them, or to reject them in ways that still allowed them to sort of live everyday lives within society. And to me, I find that particularly interesting, that this isn't about exceptionalism, right? This isn't about 100 women who managed to do it and everyone else just sort of
went with patriarchy, right? And I think that that is, there are women for whom that was true, of course, but I think that the more sort of social history research that people are doing is discovering the little ways in which women express themselves and express their agency and lived sort of their own individual powerful lives.
Mm. Yes, and if I might add something, is that one of the comments I made is precisely that a lot of these women, actually, top 10, a lot of them took other women with them. Mm-hmm. We don't hear about these women, but they were there, you know, supporting and working together. So
definitely.
And that's often a consensual style of leadership, which often men are out in the front. But you do find both styles of leadership in women's movements.
Behind every great woman is a whole host of other amazing women.
Exactly, yes.
Do you think polls like this are helpful for women's history?
So for myself, I think it is helpful. You know, like a lot of instances of sort of public popular history, they're gateways, they're introductions, they're invitations, I think is a way of thinking about it. I think the worry comes when... you know, we take a series of important women and say that is women's history, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, women's history is a lot richer. And as I say, it has a lot to do, I think, more with these sort of, or not more, but also has aspects of these movements and the social history of the everyday and of culture and of other ways of thinking about history than the sort of traditional great woman history. So I think it's great. I think it's a start.
The other thing about the list is that it engages the public.
Mm.
And I think that's a very, very important thing. And you get, you know, responses back and you could see at least from the people who filled in the form what is going on.
So you think there is that interest in women's history out there?
Absolutely.
I mean, I just get inundated with emails about the suffragette movement. I get them from Canada, from Australia, from the USA or whatever. I can't answer them all. I try to answer some of them, but and will you come and talk about this or will you do 5 minutes in this film? You know, it's just there is an awful lot of interest, particularly this year when we're celebrating the centenary of some women getting the vote in 1918. And I think, once again, it's feminist historians who have pioneered that research into lesbian, bisexual, transgender now people.
Well, yeah, we were talking, I think, just before we started recording about the move from women's studies into gender studies and the way in which what started as an attempt to recover women's history has thought very deeply and I think in very important ways about femininity, masculinity and the construction of gender and the construction of sexuality in all sorts of ways that I think have been extremely pivotal, not only to the study of history, but to the way we think about those things today as well.
Yes. So do you think... you know, if you're a historian of women's history, are you then immediately sort of labelled a feminist? And is there kind of, are there dangers in kind of writing women's history or worries that you have writing women's history?
Label as a feminist. It's not an insult at all.
No, but it's you're automatically, you know, that's what people, you are given a label. You're not just a historian of women's history.
I think so. I think it's less about labeling, although maybe that's a problem. Well, no, I think so. For me, it's an issue of sort of pigeonholing, and a dismissiveness that comes with sometimes in certain fields a woman doing women's history from certain sorts of people that I have come across, and that as someone starting out. Worried me a lot. It's increasingly worrying me less. But I think that comes from a position of privilege and having a job and publishing some books and everything else, especially within my field, which is intellectual history, aka history of political thought, which is extremely male dominated, always has been, hopefully won't always be. And the subject matter of which is traditionally male. If you look at the canon in intellectual history, it's men, 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 many men, men, Wollstonecraft, more men, Hannah Arendt. And that is the canon. And so starting out, I felt, well, you know, I really would love to work on, I don't know, Christina Pizan or some of the amazing women writing in the Renaissance. And there's so many of them. And if you're interested in that, the Other Voice in Early Modern Europe series is fantastic. And there's a whole host of books written in the Renaissance by women that they've published. And if I wanted to do any of that, I felt I had to publish on Machiavelli and Hobbes first, or else I didn't have a seat at a very important table, that I wasn't able to talk about, you know, the white dead guys, that somehow, yeah, marginalized, pushed me, excluded me away from the mainstream conversations. And I think that that's a dangerous thing, and that's a very negative thing. Rather, it should be that if I'm working on Christina Pizan or whoever else, and Dowrich, Wollstonecraft, whoever it might be, that should be then brought to the main table instead of going off in a side room somewhere, metaphorically speaking. And so I think that's something that can be a difficulty in certain fields, certainly my own. I don't know about others.
I mean, I'm chair of the Women's History Network, and we have about 400 members, and we have a conference every year. And most of those people there, I think, have struggled to get women's history onto the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's different for me. I have the title Professor of Women's and Gender History, and I'm older than some of you young ones starting out. And I mean, I have no difficulty with being identified as a feminist historian. And feminist historians, I think, have paved the way for women's history in this country. What is interesting to me as editor of Women's History Review is that we publish a lot of articles on a wide variety of topics, but it is now becoming less feminist, I think, women's history. But even the very act of making some women visible, I think, is a feminist act. So, you know, it doesn't worry me in that way.
Sorry,
I was just going to say, I think women's history is diversifying. Another thing we may want to consider, it's not only historians who write women's history now. You have got literary scholars coming in, cultural studies, you know, a whole lot of people from other disciplines. And I think that is good because it enriches it.
Yes, I would agree with you. Sociologists are doing a lot of work on women's history. Yeah. And as for being pigeonholed, well, I have been pigeonholed and I'm used to being pigeonholed, and it just doesn't stop me. So that.
Do you think we're going to reach a sort of saturation point with topics like the Tudors, and we're going to start seeing...
After I publish my book, then we can do it. Exactly. Yeah, then that's fine.
And then perhaps we will see more of these sort of stories, you know, becoming sort of bigger and more noticeable.
No, I'm interested in all that because, for example, Elizabeth I is not there.
No.
And many people are really regretting it. And I regret it. Why? Because it's still part of colonial history that we don't talk about. You know, she did lend one of her ships to Hawkins to go and get, you know, African captives. Well, I would have liked to see her there so that we can start that conversation as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is one of the, we've had a lot of people commenting that, you know, where is Elizabeth I?
Yeah.
And I think that was a deliberate omission, I think, by Susanna. I think she was, I think perhaps it was, you know, perhaps... We do talk about Elizabeth I so much, but then, like you say, on the other hand, having her inclusion would then open other stories as well.
Yes,
you know, these are names that we've grown up with. You know, you're taught from primary school, you're taught about the Tudors, Henry VIII and his wives. You know, is this kind of maybe we need more of to broaden history at a young level to kind of get other histories told?
I think, you know, we discussed this a little bit last year as well when we were talking with Greg Jenner. And I mean, I think absolutely a lot of it has to do with school teaching. And one of the things that has struck me as someone who teaches them right after they come from school is how well-versed and how interested
so many students that I get in first year are in Russian history, which to me isn't, you know, you don't see it around as much as something like the Tudors or anything like that. But because they've started learning it in school in a fairly sort of concentrated fashion, it's something that they're very, very interested in. So I think that that does have a lot of power. Momentarily in defense of the Tudors. I mean, there are, I think, a lot of reasons why it is such a captivating period. And I think it has a lot to do with its context, its moment in time in the Renaissance as well, and the way in which that leads to certain sort of topics and discussions in that period. And one of the you know, the elephant in the room, as you said, is sort of Elizabeth I. Why isn't she here? I responded to that with, well, Anne Boleyn, actually, to me, I think if we're looking for sort of influence, is another contender, actually, and not because, you know, she seduced the King of England, but because she was an intelligent woman who did certain things with this very short queenship and so on and so forth, as well as, of course, giving birth to Elizabeth I herself. But I think with this list, it is quite good that we do get away from the Tudors. I think it provides opportunities to talk about other periods. But there is still work to be done in that period, as you were saying, ways of thinking about this period in different ways that maybe take into account a sort of post-colonial discourse, that maybe think about women's history as not just big women like Elizabeth I, but think about certain things that happened during the Tudor period, the way in which actually women, if we want to think about straight lines of progress, which we probably shouldn't, but to simplify it, there was a step back in this period for women and how independent they could be and what they could do and the roles that they were assigned in that period to do with the Reformation and various other things. So I think that there's still work to be done there, as well as thinking about other periods of history.
I think you've also got to look at the context of history as taught in our universities. It's expensive to do a history degree or any degree, and of course, all this emphasis now on employability, as far as I can make out, you know, applications for history are declining. And that has profound implications, I think, for what is studied, as well as for women's history.
Yeah. I was about to say many students all over the country are very receptive to different history than the Tudors, actually. And I see across, well, in our department, various history, the spies, colonial history, they're actually open to learning something else.
Yeah, there's a demand for alternative perspectives to history, I think, especially amongst students, you know. I mean, if anybody is going to want alternative, non-mainstream stuff, it's probably going to be 18 and 19-year-olds, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is an opportunity there to be creating different sort of courses and creating, therefore, an audience for a very different sort of history in magazines like this.
Yeah. I was recently at a big women's history conference in Vancouver, and one of the themes that came up there, particularly from the people giving papers, was that there was greater gender fluidity, amongst students, younger students coming in today. So I think that may sort of push some of these marginalised areas much more into research. But of course, don't forget, you know, universities have been very criticised at the moment. There's less recruitment of younger people coming in. And so they've got all these influences, I think, shaping what is studied and what is popular in women's history.
If we were to do, say, this poll again in, say, 50 years' time, if the magazine's still going, do you think we'd see the same sorts of women on the list, or do you think we're going to see like a whole, where would you like this sort of thing to go? Where would you like to see women's studies in the next sort of 50 years or so?
I mean, my initial reaction, and I may rethink this, is I would love it if no one who's on the list
this year would be, maybe in 50 years' time they could again. But, you know, if this were done in next year or in 3 or 5 years' time, I would love to sort of say, okay, we acknowledged all these women, off they go, whole new 100. Mm. And I think that that would be the sort of most beneficial and interesting way of doing something like this. Is just to wipe it clean and say there's plenty of women. We don't need to go to the same ones. Let's talk about a whole new 100.
No, I tend to disagree with that. I think there's some evergreens here. can I use that word? Who will reappear in another 50 years. But I think you'll find much more emphasis upon bisexual women, lesbian women. I think that sexuality focus will come through. But the evergreens will still always be there. Mary Wollstonecraft, Emmeline Pankhurst, you know, some of these big figures.
Well, I did think that it was Anglophone mostly list.
Yes. Yeah.
That's why, for example, the first one, Marie Curie, for example, there are schools. I wasn't surprised at all because there are schools, you know, streets or all sort of things in Paris about her. So as far as the list is concerned, I would agree with the evergreen ones. But what I would like to see really is those so-called ordinary women who actually shaped the world. Can I just say one?
Of course, yeah.
Actually, I was thinking about these African-American women who we've seen, whose stories have been, filmed with hidden stories, hidden history. What is it?
Hidden figures.
Great. Yeah. Oh,
yes.
Catherine. Yeah. I mean, Catherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson. Mm-hmm. NASA engineers, mathematicians. Well, I would love to see those stories. Yeah. Really, really, all of them in all sort of areas.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I hate to sort of say the same again, but, you know, I'd love an opportunity to see sort of movements or groups of women being included so that it isn't just the individuals. Because I think, especially going back, that's either all one can recover or that was simply the way that it was historically, that it was a group. And to take one person out of that group or try to identify somebody in a group is not necessarily going to capture it. You know, I'm thinking about sort of riots and revolutions in the early modern period that were incredibly important and often led by women, you know, some of these bread riots and so on and so forth, and put a lot of pressure on politics and changed things. But you're going to struggle to pick one woman out of that crowd, even to give her a name, let alone say, she was responsible in some way. So some opportunity to think about that, I think, would also, I think, lead us into a bit more of what women's history, at least to me, sort of represents.
And you've got this movement as well in history, much more pronounced in the USA than here, towards international history, transnational history. And, you know, a lot of the conferences I go to, particularly in the USA, there's much more of up there than we find here. So it, global history, you know, it is developing slowly.
That was Joanne Poole, Olivette Otelli and June Purvis talking about our 100 Women Who Changed the World poll. And as I mentioned at the start, you can read more about it in the September issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Plus, there's additional content on our website at historyextra.com/100womenresults. And do look out for some videos from this panel discussion, which will be appearing on historyextra.com soon. Meanwhile, Olivette Otelli is going to be one of the speakers at our History Weekend in Winchester in October. For more details of this and our event in York, please visit historyweekend.com. And we've now come to the end of today's episode, but we'll be back on Monday to discuss Scottish and Catalan nationalism over the centuries.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.